Country Life on Midlands 103. Brought to you by W. Orshaw Burlington Business Park Tullamore, your main supplier of New Holland tractors in the Midlands. WORshaw.ie.
And you're welcome to Country Life with me, Claire O'Brien, filling in tonight for MJ, who's taking a very well-deserved rest. Tonight on the programme, flooding at the Callows, another August, the prospect of further flooding on some of the most biodiverse and fertile lands in the Midlands. Farmers are calling for action. Dairy calf to beef, is it for you? Could it be for you? Whether you're a suckler farmer or a dairy farmer, the Irish Farmers Journal are inviting you to their Dairy Calf to Beef event in Cashel on Tuesday. Adam Woods brings us up to speed. And cuts to farm payments. IFA says no thank you, and they want improvements to the National Reserve. Deputy President Brian Rush will be making the case. But we will start tonight with biodiversity, and there is no one better to tell you everything you ever wanted to know about the birds and the bees than Eanna Launa, who will be the guest of Laois County Council and the Library Service for a talk on biodiversity in Laois during Heritage Week. And I hope that I am joined on the line by Eanna. Are you there?
I'm here indeed, if you can hear me now.
I can hear you perfectly. You're welcome to the programme. Eanna, is there anything we still need to know about the birds and the bees?
Well, in that sense, I suppose not. But I'm sure we can we can know all of, you know, there's a huge amount we need to know, because we need to know how important they are to ourselves, how important they are for the environment. And we need to know what conditions we need to encourage them, because the numbers of the birds and the bees are declining with changes in land use and changes in conditions for them. So that's why we have National Biodiversity Week every year, to spell out the importance of biodiversity and to help people to realise that the environment and our surroundings are not the enemy. And then all this talk about, you know, land use changes and trying to stop them, if we don't actually act to keep all of this going, there won't be any action to be taken in 30 years' time, because it'll be too late.
I suppose when people are looking at what's happening all around the world and they're seeing fires across Europe and floods in Kentucky, and they're seeing the Amazon rainforest being knocked down to produce other kinds of crops, and people are saying to themselves, oh, what difference does it make here in little old Laois or Offaly or Westmeath if I mow the grass or don't mow the verges?
Yeah, but that's a ridiculous attitude to take, I have to say, because we are educated people. We're a first world country. We produce as much carbon into the atmosphere as 55 million people do in Africa, because we are so wealthy. So that if we won't actually, with our education and our knowledge, if we won't take a stance, then how can we expect anyone else to do? I mean, you must remember that it was in Ireland that we started with the no smoking ban. We were the first country to actually do that. We were the first country to bring in a tax on plastic bags, little old Ireland, and now these things have spread all around the world. So we can't sit back and say it doesn't matter whether I mow the grass or not. How can you expect anybody else to do it if you're not doing it yourself?
Well, Eanna, tonight, for the next 7 or 8 or 9 minutes, I am going to make you the Minister for Biodiversity, and you have a seat at the Cabinet table. And I want to know what is on your list.
Yeah, well, I mean, 7 minutes on the Cabinet table, 7 years at the Cabinet table wouldn't be enough. Because, you know, I mean, I've listened to all of this now for the last while. You know, it's all like St. Augustine, make me pure, but not yet. We see it. It's in our face. It's how climate is changing. But I don't want to change the way I live. I don't want to change my standard of living, because I want to go on the way I am. And as a consequence, if everybody taking this attitude, it means we have all the aspirations, we have all these targets, but nobody will do it. So, you know, this is the problem. People have to realise that this is not something that, you know, somebody else is going to be doing. Our children, our grandchildren will suffer if we do not do the things that are being asked of us. And that's, I don't know how this can be brought across. I mean, there's green schools, the children have been told all this in school. The children are the ones that are growing up and going to face the world we're living behind. We can make the changes, but we're not willing to do it.
Well, you're the minister now. So what would be the changes that you would make? What would you encourage us or make us do, incentivize us or punish us for not doing, if you had that choice? What would be on your top three requests.
Yeah, but see, that's easy to say, but it's not possible to actually do. I mean, we have all these targets. They've brought in targets for 2030. They've brought in targets for reducing agricultural emissions by 25%, and they're kicking and screaming they won't do that, even though 36% of our emissions up into the atmosphere come from agriculture. They're giving out about the amount of petrol we use. We have 2 million cars in this country, 2.2 million, and of those there's about 100,000 electrical ones. All the rest of them are burning fossil fuels, putting it up into the atmosphere, and yet you can't get charge units put in place, you can't get things expedited. I live in a terraced house, I can't charge a car at home because you can't put the wires across the footpath. They can do it in other countries, why can't they do it there? So, like, you know, but I mean, it's one thing to actually say, I am the minister, I want this done, but you know, this is a democracy, it's not a dictatorship, so there's objections, there's discussions, the opposition oppose it, you know, it's pushing the stone up a hill. And I don't wish to say that I wish to be a dictator, but you know, sometimes things are slower than you want, even if you are the minister.
Well, I suppose the idea is the framework. If you had three wishes, what would they be? What would be the three things that you would do that would immediately, in your view, make a difference? If you could make those things happen.
But you think we wanted to do this magic number of three. I mean, I wish that we would actually adopt the decisions we have been taking and roll them out as quickly as possible. I mean, and you can say that for any of the areas. I mean, we should have more electricity made from renewables. We should have, we should be able to make our houses more carbon neutral. But if you try to do that, and I have children trying to do this in their houses, it's impossible to do. It's impossible to get grants. Possible to get the people to do the work, because you know, so I mean, how do you imagine up more people to do the work? How do you imagine up more materials when there's such world restrictions on, you know, so like, I mean, it's not good enough just to say this is what I want to do and I want it done now, if it can't be done the way things are doing. And it's not just Ireland that's making these decisions, it's a global thing. But you know, the more we get disasters, the more we get heat waves, the more we get people leaving their homes from burning forests, the more there will be a clamour to do this.
I suppose from a listener's point of view, the question is, what, you know, you're going to be talking at, you'll be giving a talk on the 17th of August about biodiversity.
Biodiversity.
And what will you be saying at that?
Well, what I'd be saying to that is, you know, first of all, people have to know what biodiversity they have around. They have to see that it's important. I have to get people to stop saying, oh, I hate wasps and I don't like snails and I wish we didn't have magpies and things like this, that they pick and choose and they see aspects of the environment as being their enemy. I mean, you have to make people understand that the thing works as a whole. You can't have one bit of it here and like things and not liking other things. You have to make people understand that planting trees important, that it isn't just the trees that are native Irish species, other trees that are evergreen, which grow for 24/7 rather than just for half the year because they have leaves all the year round, that all of those things have to have a role. So I'll be saying all those things in the hope that I will educate people to be more positively disposed towards the rules and regulations that the government are trying to put in place, rather than opposing them to nail when it affects their parish, their farm, their land.
And I get the impression that you seem very pessimistic about the possibility of real change actually happening, of real engagement with positive impact in terms of biodiversity.
I don't want to be pessimistic, but I've been at this carry-on for years. We had plans for the year 2000. We had plans for 2010. We were having 2020 vision. We're now talking about 2030. There are targets for 2050. And they're slipping all the time. They're not actually being tightened up. Everything is being pushed out. I mean, anyone with a tit or a whiff would have to be pessimistic that it's not being taken seriously. So either I go away and hide under a stone, stone, or I continue to educate people, which is what I've been trying to do, giving talks, explaining, you know, being funny, being nice about it, showing the nice pictures, saying these things really need to exist and we need to make space in our lives for them, rather than mowing the grass and putting out weed killer and killing all the weeds, as we call them, around our houses, rather than seeing them as wildflowers. I mean, people are still spraying the roadside verges beside their houses with weed killer and thinking that's improving their environment. What are they like?
Well, it would be fair to say that certainly in the last 2 years we've seen a lot of that, and we've seen a lot of people called out for doing that when it has been happening. You know, so a lot of that on social media, people saying, look, here's somebody who has sprayed off their verges there. Do they not realise they don't need to do that? You know, there is progress. There is an awareness there maybe at the moment that wasn't there 2 years ago. We're seeing a lot of people spread planting wildflowers in places that they previously would have mown down. There is some action being taken, isn't there?
Yeah, which is great, which is absolutely marvellous, and I really, really welcome all of this, and the more we have of it, the better. So that's why I partake in Biodiversity Week every year and give talks, and I'll be doing one the following week in Greigna Manor, walking along the River Barrow and looking at the plants and the importance of rivers too. So, you know, I'm continuing to do it. So obviously I must think I'm doing something. What do they say? The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and, you know, and expecting the same result. So I'm doing the same thing over and over again and hopefully expecting a better result.
Well, we shall encourage you in that all the way in. And thank you for chatting to us on Country Life this evening. And that event is happening on the 17th of August at 6 o'clock. And thanks a million for chatting to us on the programme.
I look forward to talking to people. Yeah, thank you very much.
Talk to you again soon. Take care. And that is Eanna Launa, and she is, as I said, speaking on the 17th of August, which is a Wednesday evening, about what you can do to improve biodiversity in your area. We're going to take a quick break, and after that we'll be talking to Adam Woods from the Farmers Journal, because if you're interested in the possibility of perhaps producing dairy beef, well, he's going to be the man to tell you a little bit about it and some of the research that they have done. Stay with us on Country Life on Midlands 103. Welcome back to Country Life on Midlands 103. And still to come on the programme, I'll be chatting to the IFA's Brian Rush. He says that linear cuts to farm payments are unacceptable and he wants a national reserve for young farmers. That is still to come on the programme. But in the meantime, I am joined on the line by Adam Woods. And Adam is no stranger to you and indeed no stranger to the programme. The Irish Farmers Journal Dairy Beef National Open Day is taking place next Tuesday, the 9th of August. And Adam is going to tell us all about it. Adam, you're very welcome to the programme. And as you'd say yourself, you have a big old day next week. Tell us what's happening.
We have indeed, Claire. Yeah, it's our National Dairy Calf to Beef Open Day. It takes place on Cashel in County Tipperary on Tuesday, the 9th of August. Look, it's a big day for the industry. It's a big day for beef farmers. It's a big day for dairy farmers. Back in 2019, we started this project. I suppose we anticipated more and more interest in dairy calf to beef systems. I suppose with the dairy herd expanding, we're seeing more and more of our beef come from the dairy herd. So with that comes challenges. And we wanted to answer maybe some of those challenges or some of the questions that farmers may have before embarking or even when they're doing it, those dairy calf to beef systems on the farm. And we've 150 calves being reared down there. So we've 300 animals down there at the moment. They're all being reared straight through to slaughter. So we purchase the calves from dairy farmers, bring them onto the farm, rear them, and try and do everything right that we can the whole way through and try and demonstrate to farmers what we're doing on the farm. And look, like Tullamore Farm, we meet challenges, we get things wrong, but we write about that and we try. There's learnings in that, I guess, for farmers.
Well, tell me what you have learned so far. What have you got wrong? What have you realised doesn't work and could be done in a better way? What has been that learning since those 150
animals
came?
The biggest thing is genetics, I suppose, Claire, in terms of the role that genetics has to play on that farm. We're trying to aim for the very best genetics. So the calves that we purchase from dairy farms, we go to those dairy farms when they're breeding those cows and we get them to use specific bulls for us that are pretty high in carcass weight and pretty high in growth. And really, you would question, I suppose, not doing anything less than that, because really we're even challenged there to make money out of some of these calves in terms of bringing them straight through and doing everything right. I guess silage quality as well. Anybody looking at this system you have to get silage quality right for that first winter, because if we're going in with a lot of concentrate, especially this year coming where concentrates are heading for €500 a ton, you're really going to erode any profit that's in that system. So 75 DMD silage is an absolute must. And then grass, I suppose, is the last piece to make sure that you have your grass quality correct the whole way along. We need these animals to be gaining 0.9 of a kilo a day, 1 kilo a day in some cases. And without hitting those targets, we won't hit our profit target. So there's no room for error. There might be a little room for error in a suckler system in terms of technical efficiency, but on a dairy calf to beef system, everything is so, so tight. And if you get it wrong, it can go really, really wrong. And it won't be worth doing, I guess, if that happens.
This is essentially recycling in some ways, isn't it? Because the dairy calf is effectively, in the dairy industry, it's effectively a waste product, isn't it?
Well, yeah, maybe waste product might be a bit too strong a word, I guess. What we're trying to show that if we use the right bull or the correct bull on that cow, that yes, a beef farmer can make money out of that calf. But it's really, really important. Well, this is a day of equal importance to dairy farmers as it is to beef farmers, especially where we're going with emissions targets. And there's going to come further pressure on stocking rates and where we're going in relation to animal numbers in this country. So it's really important that any animals we do have on the ground, that they're good and they're profitable and that the beef farmer makes money out of them, because it creates a huge issue for the dairy industry. If beef farmers can't make money out of the beef calves that come from the dairy herd, well, then the dairy farmer has a problem in terms of selling those calves and getting a market for those calves. And I suppose looking even further down the line, you could look to live exports, and whether will live exports be where they are now in 10 years' time, you'd have to say they will come under pressure as well, probably from an EU point of view. So it's just timely to be looking at to making sure that beef farmers are fully tooled up and have the full technical advice there as regards rearing calves, getting everything right. And then the dairy farmer as well sees the importance of that in terms of using a good bull on dairy cows. Heretofore, for the last 5-10 years, dairy farmers have been pretty concerned with short gestation, very easy calving genetics, and they've really forgotten about the quality of the bulls that they're using. That needs to change. It needs to change very, very quickly before we go down the road where beef farmers just turn away from this system.
And have our beef farmers currently turned towards this system? Are they interested in taking the dairy calf, or is that as the way it is in lots of places? You know, if something happens to the suckler calf to keep the cow going, you end up, you know, maybe with the dairy calf to fill a gap. Reluctantly.
We've seen a lot of interest actually there over the last couple of years where possibly farmers have reduced suckler cow numbers and they've looked at a dairy calf to beef system to run alongside their suckler herd. We've seen other farmers who have said, well, look, I'm the wrong age maybe for suckler cows. I can't calve them anymore. They're too hard to work. I'll go rearing calves and it might be a little bit easier. And anybody that's done that, to be honest, has got on quite well. Some issues there with quality and those issues remain in terms of the quality of the calves that we're getting from the dairy herd, but there genuinely is an awful lot of interest there around rearing calves and running that dairy calf to beef system alongside a suckler herd. Very easy to run, very quiet animals, and can sort of boost, you know, cash flow on that farm. And look, it's a reality, as I said, that numbers are going to increase in the coming years. So something is going to happen to those calves. So it's important that we find the correct route for them.
Is it fair to say that this is a system that benefits the dairy farmer at the moment much more than it benefits the suckler the beef man?
Yeah, well, especially for some of the calves, because we're looking, we've a number of different breed types on the farm. We've Angus calves, we've Hereford calves, we've Belgian Blue calves, we've Albrechts. And for some of those calves, especially the Belgian Blues, we're finding that those calves are almost too expensive on day one to try and make a profit out of them. So you would have to say that the dairy farmer is definitely winning in terms of that sale price for those Belgian Blue calves. And we can't make it work then in terms of we're trying to finish animals off grass at the end of the second grazing season. The Herefords and the Angus are a little bit different. They have a bonus attached to them, and that's really helping them at the end of that second grazing season. But there's always great debate around what breed and who's winning and who's losing. And look, that's what we aim to do on the day, similar to Tullamore Farm, have that discussion, have that debate, have all the industry stakeholders there that farmers can ask questions and get really good, you know, discussion and debate going on the day.
And you mentioned looking down the line, 10 years down the line, 10, 15, let's say 20 years down the line. What are we looking at in terms of suckler beef in this country? You know, are we looking at that being reduced to make way for those dairy calves?
Yeah, I think so, to be honest. I think suckler cow numbers are going to come under pressure. I think with the latest announcement last week on GHG emissions, in terms of that sector is going to come under pressure, because we're going to be looking at less animals, Claire. No matter what anybody says, people have been shirking away from the responsibility of coming out and saying we're going to have less animals here.
I'm sure, Adam, you can see the eye rolling and you can hear the swearing that, you know, that suckler farmers are saying, you know, when they're hearing this again, that the suckler farmer is going to be sacrificed to an extent to make way for the dairy farmer who's already doing very well, thank you very much.
That's really frustrating. I'm a suckler farmer and I write for suckler farmers, and it's really frustrating for me to see that, because I feel suckler farmers are already on that road, because we've seen a 5% reduction in suckler cow numbers since 2018. And I don't want to pit one sector of farming society against another, but for me, the suckler farmer stocked at 1.2 or 1.3 lysic units at a hectare spread and a low amount of nitrogen at a low stocking rate isn't probably an issue here. But I think they're probably going to come under pressure, because the dairy farmer is going to come under pressure for stocking rates, so they're going to look for more land, and they'll probably have the capability to maybe, you know, price other dry stock farmers out of it in terms of renting land. So that might lead to reduced stocking rates on dry stock farms. It might lead to reduced dry stock numbers. But I guess who knows as regards what supports will come in. But it's an absolutely mammoth task. We're going to see transformation in both the dairy and the beef sector in the next 10 years. And I don't think anybody realised how big a change it's going to be in the next 10 years.
Is it too soon to know whether these animals are suitable for feedlots?
No, I suppose people sometimes get frustrated in terms of quality beef. This is quality assured beef in terms of from the dairy herd. We're hitting carcass specs on that farm. We're killing over 230 kilos carcass weight. And we're probably grading an O or an R, but we're within supermarket spec, and it's quality beef as well. I guess in terms of whether it's a whole other argument there as regards whether we need a premium for suckler beef. I would have said in the past that we do need a premium for suckler beef in terms of the increased costs associated with keeping a suckler cow. But as regards the beef quality or the eating quality of the beef that we're producing on that farm at Aberdeen, it's a tariff for beef. It's attaining the bonuses. It's attaining the quality assurance bonus. It's in spec, so it's perfect. It's perfect quality.
So those people who head down to Cashel on Tuesday, what can they expect? What's the programme for the day?
Yeah, so farm tours will kick off at 10:30, and we'll have sort of stops along the way. So you stop maybe 10, 15 minutes, listen to speakers, move on to the next stop. We have a stop on finance. We have a stop on soil fertility. Andy Doyle is coming down to us to get into a hole to actually look at the soil profile on the farm and talk about how soil health is really, really important to growing grass. We've got a calf rearing stop. We've got a grass management stop. We're going to do a little live demo in the yard in terms of handling animals as regards what the level of finish is on. And then we've got the forum to discuss the future of dairy beef in Ireland. And we've got a number of key speakers there, industry stakeholders, to get, again, good discussion and debate. We have great discussion and debate on Tullamore Farm and organics. And we hope to get the same in Cashel on Tuesday. So gates open at 10:30. Everybody welcome. Admission is free. Car parking is free. And hope to meet everybody on the day.
Adam Woods, thanks a million for talking to us on Country Life this evening. And of course, you'll get all the details about that event on the Farmers Journal website. After the break, Brian Rush will be with us from the IFA. Stay with us on Country Life on Midlands 103. And you're welcome back to Country Life with me, Claire O'Brien, sitting in for MJ. Still to come on the programme, I'll be talking a little bit later to Pat Walsh about the prospect of flooding on the Shannon Callows and what that will mean for farmers in Offaly and Westmeath should that happen again this summer. But at the moment, I am joined on the line by Brian Rush, who is the Deputy President of IFA. And he said it is unacceptable that there would be additional linear cuts on existing entitlements for farmers. And Brian, you're very welcome to the programme this evening.
Good evening, Claire.
Talk to us a little bit about the meeting that took place recently with the Direct Payments Advisory Committee.
Yeah, so at that meeting, we were informed. So first of all, I would represent IFA in that meeting as well as the Charter of Rights. But at that meeting, we were informed that for the year, for 2022, that the amount of applications for the National Reserve in effect doubled. So there was 1,600 applications for National Reserve entitlement. And compared to 2021, there was only 750. And the reason behind that surge was that the upper income limit for all farm income was removed. So that allowed more people to apply. So previous to this, if you earned more than €40,000 off farm, you couldn't apply for National Reserve. Now with that being lifted, that has allowed another flush of applications in, which has resulted, and that has to be funded, obviously. Those extra National Reserve entitlements have to be funded, and they're being funded by a linear cut to everyone's single farm payment.
Well, would the handy way be for that be to reimpose that cap, or would you be against that?
No, sure, we're in favour of that. I suppose if you look at the entitlements, what the National Reserve entitlements are to, you know, obviously people of naked hectares or new entrants to farming or young farmers, if they're going to be making their living off of farming and they're trying to build an enterprise and they need farming, like they're relying on farming for their income, I think the cap on off-farm income is a good thing, because it means the entitlements are going to people that really need them. With the removal of the off-farm income limit, you could be earning any amount of money off-farm and you could apply for entitlements. And I just think it sends out the wrong message, and it's just not something we're in favour of. Like, 100% in favour of supporting new farmers, our young farmers and new farmers and new entrants. But I do think there has to be a limit. There has to be a limit on it. And then asking farmers to fund those National Reserve entitlements, you know, by a linear cut, there's a level of unfairness in it that I'm just not happy with.
Okay. And did the possibility of reimposing that cap, was that mentioned at your advisory meeting?
Well, my understanding was that this came from Europe, right? The commission told the Irish Department, and we would have flagged it. We were informed at the beginning of the year that the commission had instructed our department to do this, and we would have flagged it, that we felt that this was opening the door too wide. And would result in a big flush of applicants. Because previous to now, most of the time is that National Reserve would be funded from unused entitlements and the young farmer schemes.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no need for a linear cut. So you'd have to be concerned going forward if this threshold remains removed, if the upper limit isn't reinstated, that this will become an annual occurrence.
That there'll be cut upon cut.
Yeah, there'll be a linear. Yeah, that they'd have to go and take a linear cut off people's entitlements in order to fund that.
Well, the other alternative is that it's not a financial cap that is the discriminating factor, that there is some other feature, perhaps maybe an age feature, so that we end up in a situation where it is mostly young farmers who benefit from whatever limited pot of funding is there.
Yeah, well, young farmers or new entrants, because people can get into farming for a whole manner of reasons and later
course,
in life, whatever else it is. And if they're trying to start, like, the whole purpose of your entitlements is to supplement your income and aid your enterprise. And, you know, new entrants and young farmers who are going to be relying on farming do need that. So it's important that they get that support. But people coming into the industry with a substantial off-farm income, I think it's right for us to question the value of supporting those people, those farmers, those new entrants with entitlements.
Okay, when they can well afford to buy them.
Well, yes, absolutely, can well afford to buy them. But also, you know, where is it being funded from? So if they want to be funded, it should be funded from a separate pot of money. I don't think it's fair to be taking money from an ever decreasing pot anyway, because, you know, the pressure is on the cap budget all the time to fund that. It just seems, it feels as if it's spreading a thinner all the time. And, you know, we're just flagging. I suppose I put my hand up at the meeting and I said, listen, I'm not comfortable with it, and I didn't feel it was the right way to go. And we were very, very strong with the department on that. You know, and it will form, you know, we'll continue with that as well.
So there was a previous suggestion, I think, that the unused funds from the Young Farmer Scheme would fund the National Reserve. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, and that has been the what's happened previous years. But the problem we had in this year was there was always enough unused funds in the Young Farmer Scheme to cover the National Reserve. Well, nearly every year there was enough funds in the Young Farmer Scheme to cover the National Reserve. But because they opened the door wider now by removing the upper income limit, we're actually seeing a doubling in the amount of applications. So there's simply not enough funding in the unused farmer and on the unused young farmer fund to fund the National Reserve.
It seems like bonkers economics, really, doesn't it? The logic behind the, obviously it's a directive that has come from the EU, but how are other countries managing it? What are they doing?
You'd presume that if Ireland have been told that every other country is doing, I don't know, Claire. I don't know how it's funded. I would presume it's a closed pot the same as ours. But maybe other countries have a higher level of unused funds or more fat in the system that they can fund the national reserve. But if you just listen, the figure here, I suppose, per entitlement isn't huge. It's 0.6% of every entitlement. But that's coming on top of a cut, on top of convergence, on top of all the measures that have happened and will happen in the new reform that is putting pressure all the time on the farmers, on direct supports for farmers.
Yeah, at a time, as you say, when farmers are under more and more pressure. And I don't think you have seen this already, but the Farmers Journal have a 20-page supplement tomorrow about emission targets and the impact that the targets are likely to have. And I suppose one of the things that Feilim O'Neill would be writing about is that there is no way to achieve any level of carbon emissions reduction beyond 18% or thereabouts without resorting to cutting livestock numbers. That's no surprise to you, I suppose, but it's not popular news.
No, it doesn't come as a surprise, and he's right to say so. 18% could be achieved by adopting current measures, and then there will be, like, the IFA position was to look at the lower end and put her hand up and say that we could move towards the lower end of the range, which we were given, which is 22%. And there was a path there to achieve that, but using future technology. But to go to 25%, it's very hard to see how that can be achieved without reducing cattle numbers in the system somewhere. Now, it does say in the agreement that any measures introduced will be voluntary, and I think that is important, but still, we need to see a plan from this government of how they're going to achieve this 25%, and we need to see how farmers can move towards achieving that.
Yeah, I think tomorrow in Feilim's report, he'll be saying that finishing up with a 25% cut in emissions will mean a loss somewhere between 1.1 billion and 3.9 billion euros, potentially somewhere in the region of 2.5 billion if a straight mathematical calculation is applied using, and he says, using the same formula, we could expect a potential reduction in the beef cattle herd of around 13% and 11% in the dairy herd, which will come at a cost to farm incomes estimated at potentially 21% for beef farmers and 15% for dairy farmers. Now, 21% of not a big income is an awful lot compared to 15% of what might be a very substantial income in some cases, based on dividing the difference between the cost of a 21% reduction and a 30% reduction. That's going to put people to the wall.
Yeah, and we've heard a flag that. I did it myself as well in terms of anything we've said. And even in response to the Minister, Minister Eamon Ryan was coming out with some lovely language about renewables and anaerobic digestion. But anyone, any farmer who has tried to get involved in renewables will tell you how difficult and how tough that has been in order to get any project off the ground. So, like, the government coming out with 25%, they put out a figure of 25% there. They've given us no clear indication how to achieve it. And I think farmers themselves, you know, we're realistic about this. We do understand that we need to reduce our emissions and our environmental footprint. And we put our hand up and said we can achieve X. But, like, it's just not fair or equitable. If you look at 25% for farmers to take a hit in income, and often what we saw in terms of the argument used against farming, and this is, well, if farming has a lower emissions cost, the rest of society is going to have to cover the difference now with transport and energy. Well, people tend to forget farmers are involved in the rest of society. So we have to adjust and change our businesses. Many of us are going to take a hit on income. Many of us are going to take a big hit on income. But we also have to address the transport and energy emissions targets as well in our everyday lives. So that's just not a fair argument. I think farmers in rural Ireland are taking a big hit on this now. And I suppose it's only starting to dawn on politicians now at this stage what it could mean.
Yeah, you're saying that the department haven't said how they want you to do this. But I suppose if they did, we'd be here having the conversation, Brian. They told us they want us to do that and it's not feasible or it's not desirable. At least, is it fair to say that in this situation, it is up to farm organisations to maybe pull together and decide, well, you know, what are the options? Let's get the, you know, if we were in business, people would be saying the blue sky thinkers in. Let's see what are the opportunities here? Because, you know, certainly in the last week since this announcement was made, we've had lots and lots of people across local and national and airwaves saying this is a time of opportunity. There are lots of things that farmers can do. And these are some of those things. I presume you've been listening to those conversations.
I know I have. And I think farmers, there's no doubt we can create opportunity for farmers in this space. There's absolutely no doubt about it. And I would be optimistic in my view on that. And I do think farmers, given an option and an opportunity to strengthen their income, they will take those options and they look at them seriously. But the thing that we need to be strong in, and I think we will be strong in, that it needs to be funded by new funding. That the government must come up with a package, a real package, in order to support income and retain the number of farmers we have in the country. Because I've heard it said before, oh, sure, we'll just have less farmers. No one wants that. I don't want it. You don't. I don't think anyone wants that. I think it's disingenuous for people to try to say that, some commentators. But that's the key around this. And farmers are telling me straight up, they're wondering what this means, what's going to happen. And they're willing to look at the options. The thing is, we need to make sure that there's opportunities in this for farmers. This isn't just about standing still. This isn't just about supporting farmers in the transition. I believe this is about providing farmers and families with opportunities from this.
Okay, finally and briefly, Brian, also in tomorrow's journal, the Department of Agriculture has confirmed the new lower limit of 220 kgs organic nitrogen per hectare will likely apply to some areas from January 2024. But how many farms will be affected and where they'll be located will not be made known until next September. So that's just 4 months before those measures will be introduced. Not ideal either, is it?
Well, sure. You can, to ask a farmer to adjust their business 4 months, you know, in 4 months is just unfeasible. It's not realistic. We'll be making that point. And I presume that's coming from, like we've heard soundness from the department, in terms of if water quality doesn't improve in an area, they will regionalise restrictions. So that's moving from 250 to 220. What I would say about that is, in terms of water quality, and farmers are very aware of the responsibilities around that, and they're making some very big adjustments on their farms to address that. This year, we've seen a massive reduction in nitrogen, not just because of the price, but because of they're learning more, they're looking at, you know, different knowledge, different technologies coming out there in terms of clover incorporation, in terms of managing slurry better. So I do think we're going to see an improvement. We've seen all the time on water quality with the department here and with the Department of the Environment as well, is that there needs to be time. The farmers need time for the measures that they have taken up in the past 2, 3, 4 years to take effect. And I've no doubt that once farmers are given a bit of space and a bit of time around this, we will see that those measures have taken a positive effect.
Okay. Brian Rush, thank you for talking to us Country Life this evening. Take care and good night. And that is the IFA's Deputy President, Brian Rush. We're going to take a quick break. Brian was talking about water there. When we come back, we'll be talking to Pat Walsh about water, 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 potentially everywhere around the Callows. Stay with us on Country Life. You're welcome back to Country Life. When we built our house, I remember my father-in-law saying, welcome to the water, because we live in an area that has been routinely, or in the past certainly routinely, flooded after particular kinds of heavy weather and heavy rain coming down off the Schlieve Blooms. It is a particular issue for people who live along the Shannon and whose land is part of the Shannon Callows. And I'm joined by one farmer from Belmont, who has particular experience of this. Pat Walsh, you're very welcome to Country Life this evening. What has happened to manage the levels on the Shannon over the last number of years, as far as you're aware?
Well, actually, very little has happened to address the water problem that's associated with the River Shannon and the Callows. When Boxer Mourne was in power, he initiated a programme for the Shannon, which involved dealing with about seven catch points that needed addressing. And none of those catch points really has been done. Now, I'll have it to say, all right, there was excellent work done below on Shocknessy's Island, below the river, below Banagher, and it was effective. But since that, and that's definitely 3 years ago, nothing worth talking about has been done. But there has been a tendency to do this work at the real wrong end of the year. Because I can remember being on Shocknessy's Island, it was in October to the best of my knowledge, and they were doing the Shannon, and next thing the winter flood arrives and it's all over. So it's there's a whole lot of restrictions preventing them, they tell us, from going in and working all during the summer. And as a consequence, that's the time when you should do it, when the Shannon, in essence, is at its lowest.
Is at its lowest. Well, we're coming into August. The weather can, as we know, be particularly volatile, and it can lead to localised flooding, the kind of rain that we saw and the flooding that we saw up in the northwest last week. What's the impact of that in your particular area when that flooding happens?
If that flooding happens during, we'll say, August, which it has happened in June, July and August, the Shannon Callow's crops are not harvested. And the farmers that are associated with that land along the banks of the Shannon lose their land. And I know the Shannon will flood. We have to accept that. But management of the Shannon can lead to that threat being diminished substantially. There's three gates, one in Athlone, one in Meelik, and one in Partine. If those three gates were managed effectively, the Shannon would be managed an awful lot better, but it's not being managed. And what happens, I had a situation recently where the Shannon rose between Athlone and Meelik by about a foot and a half, but there was no water released in Meelik to correct that, because there is no one particular body responsible for this job. It's left, there's five or six bodies associated with the rivers, you know yourself,
yeah.
Waterways Ireland and all those people. And yet there is no designated responsible person or body for flood management. And we've asked for that. And I have been particularly vocal in my request for that to happen over the last number of years. And that needs to happen.
And you've been calling on the minister to take immediate control of the situation. Which minister is the person to do it?
Good question. I don't know, actually, who is responsible for the Shannon. But it's definitely the responsibility of the Minister for Local Government, I'm sure, you know, to take on that project. But all you get is lip service, and at particular times you get visits. But to get the job done is... The Shannon, be quite honest, the Shannon is crying out for maintenance. You have fallen trees leaning into the Shannon. You have trees that can grow, have grown now, anting up to between 5 and 10 metres out onto the river. There is nowhere else in Europe that the rivers are totally deserted. And that's the best way of describing what happens.
Yeah. Tell me, what's the consequence? If we do not see some action soon, short-term and long-term consequences as far as you're concerned?
Well, the consequences of it is simple. The Shannon will be more volatile. It'll flood with less rainfall. And it'll deprive the people along the edge of the Shannon from their livelihood. There's also another important aspect to all this. An awful lot of birds nest and bring out their young along the edge of the Shannon. And when it floods, those nests are lost. So there is a big threat to wildlife as well along the edge of the Shannon. And as you know yourself, the Shannon is teeming with wildlife.
And yet one of the main arguments that we're given for the failure across the country to maintain rivers is that the impact that maintaining rivers might have on wildlife.
Well, that's an argument that's been put up, but it lacks foundation. Now, especially on the River Shannon, because the Shannon is always very close to the edge at all times, and very little floods the Shannon. And I know, because I've lived all my life, and I've known the Shannon, and I've fished on it, and the amount of wildlife that's just on the edge hatching out. And once the Shannon rises, their nests drift off. So it really is foolish to turn around and say you can't do work to maintain a river because of wildlife. You're only destroying wildlife.
Well, Pat Walsh, thank you very much for talking to us on the programme this evening. Really appreciate your input on that. I would hate to think that this time next year we'll be having this conversation all over again, but it wouldn't be the first time, and it depressingly is unlikely to be the last time we'll be addressing this. But in the meantime, thank you very much for talking to us this evening. And let's hope that all of the relevant ministers have been listening carefully, or at least that they get the message about the maintenance of rivers. That is it from me for this evening. I will be back next week. And next week we are focusing entirely on the Tullamore Show, which is just around the corner. You'll be getting ready. You'll be rooting out the flasks and gathering the picnic blankets and all the bits and pieces that you'll have to get ready to head to the Tullamore Show on the 14th of August. Next week's programme is all about it. And I'm really looking forward to bringing that to you and to heading out to the site in advance of the programme. So we'll be talking to you again next week. Until then, take care of yourself. Good night.